Well, welcome, dear class members, to our midweek Bible class this week. And tonight we're to continue our Corinthians series, 1 Corinthians and chapter 8, which I'm sure you'll agree has been a very positive and very practical section of scripture for us to be considering. And tonight's a new section, and chapter 8 is entitled For Whom Christ Died, and we look forward to Uncle David's remarks there. So we'll open our class with a rousing and encouraging hymn in hymn number 357. Asking tonight because not only is he our organist, but he's also our reader, and we'll call him to read 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Thanks, Pete.
Reading 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Now, as touching things offered unto idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffeth up, but love edifieth. And if any man think that he knoweth anything, he knoweth nothing yet as he ought to know. But if any man love God, the same is known of him. As concerning, therefore, the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is none other God but one. For though there be that are called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there be gods many and lords many, but to us there is but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we by him. Howbeit, there is not in every man that knowledge. For some, with conscience of the idol, unto this hour eat it as a thing offered unto an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But meat commendeth us not to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, neither if we eat not are we the worse. But take heed, lest by any means this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to them that are weak. For if any man see thee which hast knowledge sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him which is weak be emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols? And through thy knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? But when ye sin so against brethren, and wound their weak conscience, ye sin against Christ. Wherefore, if meat make my brother to offend, I will eat no flesh while the world standeth, lest I make my brother to offend.
We look forward to Brother David's remarks to the title, For Whom Christ Died. Thanks.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, and dear brethren and sisters. This night we're going to deal with a new section out of the book of Corinthians, and I don't want you to be misled in thinking that chapter 8 is the only section which deals with meats offered to idols, because it goes on into the next several chapters. So the real issue, of course, with chapter 8 is meats offered, things offered unto idols, as it says there in the AV. If you have a look in chapter 10, verses 20 and 27, you can pick up some of the thoughts again as he has refined his own standing to these things, to them in the previous chapter. Let's pick up verse 20. But I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God. And I would not that you should have fellowship with them. So he's relating, of course, the matters regarding the sacrifices which are made and their participation with it around the tables at these temples. Verse 27 is a situation which he gives guidance on. He says, if any of them that believe not bid you to a feast, and you're disposed to go, whatsoever is set before you, eat, asking no question for conscience' sake. But if any man makes a point about this, says, this meat that you are eating is offered in sacrifice unto idols, eat it not for his sake that showed it. So the subject goes beyond chapter 8. And it's very helpful for us to get that perspective. So between these two points, Paul is examining the motives and mindset and spirituality behind the brethren and sisters of the Corinthian ecclesia. This is the beginning of a new section, and it's another cause problem in the ecclesia. I've got it labelled up there, the schism at Corinth. This was another one. I mean, this is just following on, one after the other. I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, and I'm of Cephas. Well, this is another one. I'm of the weak brethren, and I'm of the strong brethren, see? And this is what it's about. This was just as divisive as any of the other issues faced by the members of the ecclesia. The problem here is things offered to idols. Brethren and sisters, Paul is a problem which grew and became a dichotomy, as it was really a problem of ecclesial attitudes. Ecclesial attitudes were destroying the meeting. There were the strong, by inference, and you won't find the word strong in the text, but you will find the word weak, and the other is therefore the strong by inference. Okay? So the next one, of course, is that the strong brethren advocated that they should boldly eat and frequent an idol's temple. They felt quite at liberty to do this as a sign of their contempt and disregard for it. They could go wherever they like, they said, and it has no consequence to them. The weak, on the other hand, were weak in conscience, as far as the labelling here goes, and they demanded nothing less than total abstinence. So the next point is that the strong brethren, they advocated that they should boldly eat these things. The weak say no, but Paul's answer is, in point three, he's not taking sides on these issues in this matter. His objective was the edification of the ecclesia. And those in the ecclesia had to see their position in that. So we've got to then put this also in a chronological perspective. So when did Paul begin to preach in Corinth? Well, I looked up one of those old Bibles, and it's got the date at the top of the page, and you know the Bibles that you buy there, fairly old English ones. So it looks like about Acts chapter 18, it's about AD 55. Right. So if you look at the writing of the book of the letters to the Corinthians, it's about AD 59. So that just gives us the perspective that if we take those dates, it's about 4 years since the meeting started, and it's fraying at the edges and internally. You can see there's a real problem there. Now, with that in mind, we need to then take view of the issues here that are being raised. And we want to date them as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Acts chapter 15 is an important day. Acts chapter 15 is an important day. We'll just have a look at this next PowerPoint. This here is Paul's second journey. There's been the Jerusalem conference. The first journey, of course, went up through Cyprus and up through here, and that was it. And the loop was greatly extended, was it not, to go and visit those and come over here into the area of Greeks, come back and report again. This is when the Corinthian ecclesia was begun. Now, this has all taken time, and we just take some of the dates with a little grain of salt. And the timing here of Jerusalem, the conference in Jerusalem in Acts chapter 15, from the same source, was around about AD 51. Now, what we need to therefore look at in this is the outcome. We're not going to go through all the rituals that were being trying to be promoted at the Jerusalem conference. We're going to have a look at this, because here we've got these four great points that come out of Acts 15, and they occur, as it were, straight after the conference. Here it is. This is what we say. Okay? Now, you are to abstain from the pollutions of idols. You are to abstain from fornication. You are to abstain from things strangled. And you are to abstain from blood. All right? Okay, so what am I getting at? Well, it's interesting that you actually have a look at the next one. In the same chapter, in verse 59, a slightly rearranged, that you abstain from meats offered to idols. See that? It's like, as it were, a rewording of that. Meats offered to idols. And there's our theme out of 1 Corinthians in chapter 8. Meats offered to idols. These were the great issues. Because, brethren and sisters, Corinth was not the only place in the world which had a temple. They're scattered all the way through the Roman Empire. It was all part of the way of life. It's like going through the great cities of Australia and finding the cult of football, right? I mean, it is the national pastime to go to a football match and to jeer and cheer. Now, I mean, for them, this was the great event of their life, these festivals and feasts and what have you that went on in their own cities, okay? So just keep that in mind. So what we want to do now is actually just put these things together and say, in Acts chapter 15, we have that edict going forward. We then have Paul turning up at Corinth and getting things working there about 4 years later. All right? And a few years later here, this huge problem has arisen. So basically, it is telling us that they have shifted the goalposts. That what good advice the apostles made in Jerusalem was discarded. And that is a very terrifying point to come to grips with. Ground rules had already been set. The apostles went about through all those cities, all the Gentile cities that we saw in the previous map here. All those cities, they went to deliver them the decrees. And no doubt, these were also carried forward as ecclesial practice. That you abstain from all these things that go with it. So, what do? We're going to see how every one of these things are related. It was like, brethren and sisters, as if they tore out that section out of their constitution and said, this doesn't apply, this ecclesia. And no wonder they had problems. And they were very, very powerful problems. Okay. So what was the problem at Corinth and elsewhere? Meats offered to idols. Like any other great city in the empire, there was this problem. Corinth was a place of many temples, where sacrifices involved eating the meat sacrifice, meat offered to idols as a sharing of the sacrifice with the friends of the offerers. In a true sense, it was fellowship. And that should immediately turn on the light, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Okay? So let's put up the next one down below here. Fornication. Right? Like many forms of idolatry, and this is nothing new, brethren and sisters, Israel had the problem when they're in the land as a kingdom. Same sort of thing. This is why they liked idolatry. Like many forms of idolatry, this was practiced as an adjunct to the idol service with a host of temple prostitutes. There were about 1,000 of these for the great temple of Aphrodite at the top. This was the great temple on top of the hill in Corinth. And you'll see the hill, and you can see it's quite a prominent landmark. The next thing, of course, things strangled. This here obviously related to sacrifices. And of course, the Jews were told that they actually had to properly let the blood. They were not allowed to eat things with blood, not allowed to eat blood, drink blood. And that was the next point underneath here. Heathen sacrifices could involve the drinking of blood. All right? And the point of all this is, of all these would have been practiced at the city of Corinth on the temple. And the ecclesia, brethren and sisters, was to stand apart from these practices. Yet some found it in their hearts to say it did not affect them. They were exercising what they thought was their right to do so. Now, what is probably very helpful here is then to have a look at some excerpts from this book of Barclay. And this is one New Testament, the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles, and also a new translation of some of the epistles in the New Testament as well. And he's got this note here just at the beginning of chapter 8. And I've got three screens on this one, so you just have to bear with it. It says there, in the next one, the chapter deals with a problem of eating meat, which had formed part of a sacrifice to a heathen idol, a subject to which Paul returns in 10 verses 25 to 32. In this matter, the Christian was faced with three problems, which in the first century was very real. So this is not just limited to Corinth. A sacrifice was seldom burned entire. A token part was burned, offered to the god, up in smoke. And then part of the meat became the perquisite of the priest. He said, this lot's mine. Okay? And part was given to the worshipper. The worshipper usually gave a meal with his share of the meat to his friends in the precincts of the heathen temple. So you could wine and dine at the temple of Aphrodite. Okay? So the next one. Most social occasions were so held. An invitation to dine usually read like this. I invite you to dine with me at the table of the Lord Serapis, or some other god, or goddess. The question was whether or not a Christian could attend such a meal. The verdict is that he could not attend because he could not, 1 Corinthians 10, sit at the table of Christ and the table of demons, with whom the heathen gods were identified. So demons are half gods. This meant that the Christian was to be, to a large extent, cut off from social life. I mean, that actually was pretty good because he could actually attend more meetings. Next point, the priests received far more meat than they could use. So the live animals went up the top, met their end. Later on, the meat carts went down below to the city below where they were sold. All right, they sold it to the shops whence it was sold to the public. Paul's verdict is that the Christian can buy in the shop and ask no questions. It may have been that that meat in that shop was not offered to idols. So he's to ask no questions for conscience' sake. Next one. He gets invited out. Sometimes the worshipper took the meat home with him and used it for a meal in his house. In this case, Paul's verdict is the Christian may eat what is put before him and ask no questions. But if someone with a sensitive conscience warns him that that meat was meat that was offered to an idol, he must push it aside, say, I cannot eat that. More for the protection of the other person's conscience than for his own sake. And you'll appreciate the comments that come out of 1 Corinthians 8 on that. However remote, he says, the whole question is from modern life, it clearly presented a social problem of the first importance for the Christians of the New Testament times. Okay, so that is the third point that he makes under the circumstances where meat could arrive. Okay, then. There's a related chapter to this, and this is Romans chapter 14. And it's not dealt with in exactly the same manner. It's a Roman ecclesia, and they have a slightly different problem. But it was judging between brethren as they looked at each other, and he became a brother which liked this, and the other brother, he didn't like that. So it just became, again, a source of problem to the conduct of the ecclesia. Let's take Romans 14 and verses 14 through to verse 17. He says, I know and am persuaded by the Lord Jesus there's nothing unclean of itself, but him that esteems anything to be unclean, to him it is unclean. If thy brother be grieved with thy meat, now walkest thou not charitably. Destroy not him with thy meat for whom Christ died. You would have picked that up in the reading in chapter 8 of Corinthians. Let not then your good be evil spoken of, for the kingdom of God is not meat and drink, but righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit. See that? So you can also pick up there the context also of love in verse 15. Now walkest thou not charitably, with margin says, according to charity, which would of course be the Greek word agape. And that's the same word that also occurs when we flip back to 1 Corinthians and chapter 8. You pick that up from verse 1. But love, or charity, edifies. Agape love is, of course, the self-sacrificial love, hence the exposition of it later on in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I'd just like to give you this perspective. And we sometimes think this is just a lovely little poem that occurs three quarters of the way through Corinthians, right? But actually, Paul is saying at the end of reviewing all those problems, he's saying there, think about that as the solution to your problem. See, it occurs here in chapter 8, verse 1, right? But love builds up. And what they were engaged in, brothers and sisters, was tearing down. Their egos were built up, but they're tearing down the ecclesial fabric. Just think about the appropriate words out of 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Love vaunteth not itself and is not puffed up. That's the words you get out of the sentiments of chapter 8 and verse 1. So, for brethren and sisters in the first century ecclesia, meat offered to idols bubbled forth as a case of true conscientious objection for the love of the brethren. Let's then have a look at this slide here, which I should have a look at, which I missed. Summarise what I've said. It's one of the outcomes. The Jerusalem Conference, it was an issue in the Corinthian Ecclesia, it was an issue in the Roman Ecclesia, and there was a genuine reason why the decrees from the Jerusalem Conference dealt with these issues. It was a common problem throughout the Roman Empire. And you can understand why it was that Paul wanted to write about it. And that was the solution which he gave to brethren there, and also it would be the solution which he would give throughout the Roman Empire when he toured these places and found the same sort of thing. All right. Now, I don't want you to be upset because I've actually got the first four verses of 1 Corinthians 8 on the screen. Now, we're actually going to look up the Bible tonight, but this is for a reason, okay? We read those verses. All right. There's one word in there that just crops up all the time. And do you know what it is? It's the word no, in its various forms. This is very helpful to understand the setting of it. No, knowledge, knowledge, knoweth, no, 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 and no. So there it is. So before you get your coloured pencils out, I hope you've got three. Okay. There are three different words in that section, and I've coloured them in for you. I know the green's a little bit hard to read, but there it is. That one there is the same as that, it's the same as that, and these three are the same, and those two are the same. Okay, now we want to find out a little bit more about these, because these are three Greek words. And you might think I've made a typo here, but that's how it should be, but it's pronounced oida. Next one is gnosis, and another one is gnosko. And that's how they occur through those four verses. And it's unfortunate, of course, that in our English translation, they've actually put it as the word no all the way through, but they have a different understanding for each of those Greek words. And it's helpful for us to get to know what some of those words are. And that's why we have the next one. The writing gets a bit smaller, but there it is. I've got down the bottom there, oida means to see or perceive. Gnosko means to know absolutely. Right? And gnosis means a sort of practical knowledge. Yeah, yeah, I know that. Okay? Now I've got down there also the other one. Whoops. Press the right button. Oikodomio, which means to build up. Okay? That's that word there. I haven't put it in there to confuse it. And of course, you actually can pick out from here, domio, domus, where you're talking about, that's where you get the word domestic from. And it's to build up a house. Okay? So what he's saying here is touching the things offered to idols, we see, perceive, we all have some practical knowledge about this. Okay? Now, they couldn't walk around the city of Corinth and say, I wonder what that building is. They all knew. Or that building. Or that one. Or that one up there. Okay? They all knew it was there, placarded before them. Public holidays were all based upon these feasts to these gods. So they certainly knew. Okay? So he therefore says, this knowledge here, this, yeah, I know it, puffs up. But he says, love builds up. And there's a little bit of alliteration in there. Okay? This sort of, I know it, knowledge puffs up. And much to my annoyance, I actually went to the show and I took a picture of a pouter pigeon in the show. And unfortunately, the camera focused on the wires instead of the pigeon. But all you saw was this great big crop, this bird there, as it sort of goes around and struts around and shows how frightening it is. Okay? I thought I'd show that one there, but it wasn't good enough. So he says there, if any man think that he knows anything, that he really sees and perceives it correctly, he says, he knows nothing. Absolutely he knows nothing yet, as he ought to know absolutely. If any man love God, the same is absolutely known of God. There's no mistake about that, he says. As concerning, therefore, the eating of those things which are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know, we perceive, point number one, that an idol is nothing in this world, and there's no other God but one. 2 points that he's made, okay? So that's how this here develops. 2 points. I've actually just gone and done this because it really is quite helpful. The writing gets smaller again. I've actually put these words in here. And again, the green isn't really readable, but it's good colour pencil time, and you can search that out later on. I will make one little proviso, though, that no matter what Greek lexicon or whatever you like to call it you actually refer to, they'll actually have the A word means this in that context, this in that context, this in that context. So I'm taking this as it comes out of vines, because it's quite often how the context of how a word is used to actually what you should ascribe to it. All right? So that is really helpful. And of course, in my searching around, I could only find that Rotherham has actually made an attempt to actually reword some of those words in there, whereas pretty well all others I saw just kept the word no. But that does help us keep some sort of context of what this is all about, because he wants to expose that they really don't know as they ought to know. Okay? Now, come to Acts, so 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1, as touching things offered unto idols. We know that we all have this knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. Okay, so we all have knowledge. And I just thought I'd just run a few of these past you, because up here is a NASA view. Of course, they didn't have that back then, but up here is Corinth, and you can see a little bit going through there. That is the Corinthian Canal. And over here somewhere, not marked, is the city of Athens. And so he went to Athens first, and he came round across to here. Now, because of the canal, it was a really cosmopolitan sort of city, and all sorts of people congregated there. It was a centre for trade, and so forth. And do you know exactly where that one is that we're looking at? Do you want me to go back to the other map? That'd be helpful. Right? It's up there. See that? So that's the isthmus up here. Okay? Across there. And of course, I don't think it's really right where it is there, but these are just hand-drawn maps. It's not a NASA map. Okay? So there it is.
Corinth is like the great city of this area here, and Achaia is there, and Athens is the great city there. So I just thought that might be helpful for you to actually see where you're looking at there, and we can just flip back through here, and hope we don't overshoot. Here we are. Okay. Now, the next thing is that this is here. No, it did. This is King William Street here. And it's just about here the trams ends. But this is King William Street for the ancient city of Corinth. And up there is the Acrocorinthus. Now, I think Acro means mount or something like that. Where it is. And up there you can see some little buildings. See that? Now, we're going to have a look up there.
This is where all the action took place.
So along here were all the little shops, okay, and all the little edifices, and this is where that man's telephone box was, and this man's post box was, and all these sorts of things. You could lean against that if you felt tired, and that's a little stadia stone instead of a milestone. But there it is. That's the area of the ancient city of Corinth. And you pick up that around here that there's lots of other new, more modern buildings around. So they've just kept that there to
keep the tourists flocking in.
Okay. Now there, as I said, that is the King William Street of Corinth. Up here at the top there, you can actually see quite a detailed set of buildings here. And look, they're still at it. They're still at it. See that? Still building. And you go up from down below, down here, and you go all the way up there. And it's right at the top there, you've got the ruins of some of these religious places. Now, we've even got this one here, which is the middle gate. There's a middle gate, and that was built by part of the time between there and now. So it wasn't all built in Paul's day. Well, what I would like to show you is this, see that line along here, that different type of stone? Apparently that is where the original stonework was in the time of Paul. So it's just letting you know that there was building works going on then, and it was part of, as it were, making the place a place to be at. Okay? And the next one, of course, lo and behold, it is on the ruins of the Temple of Aphrodite. Now, I'd just like to put this in context because it's a ruin and you won't find the usual pillars going up. It looks like a building site that went wrong. It's quite a reasonably large place and they had quite a few personnel, as already mentioned. And you're there looking at that sea in there between this blob of land and this goes up here, and that's the other area there, which over there is Athens. Okay? So this is the outer part of the outer foundations of the temple to Aphrodite. Now, this here is not Aphrodite. This is Athena. So I'm making a point out of this. This is Athena. So there she is. This is this is not real. This is a model. Okay? This is a model. And the little man down there is to give a bit of perspective. So there she was, dressed up in all the regalia. Okay, you see how they like to house them as great statues and make men and women feel very small. Okay, so imagine that, one of these great big temples, and you're there. Now, the great temple, the great goddess of Athens, of course, was Athena. That sounds logical, doesn't it? Athena. The great goddess of Corinth was Aphrodite. And I can't show a picture of that. She's not dressed up like that. But next one is, I'll just scan this out of a book on Greek mythology. And those in the front row still can't read this. I'll just read it. Aphrodite, the goddess of love and beauty, presided, the poet Hesiod said, over girlish babble and tricks. Does that apply? Okay. It goes on, wherever she walked, flowers sprang up. This is the folklore about it. Sparrows and doves flew about her. To Ares, her lover, she bore several children, among them fear and terror. See that? So it's a whole lot of folklore built up about it. But she had the power to beguile even wise gods, and often placed temptation in the path of Zeus, making him forget the love of Hera, his sister, and his bride. So she was a temptress. And of course, we needn't go any further on that. The next one, of course, I had to show you some pillars. These are Corinthian pillars. This was the temple of Apollo, and a bit of it's still standing. Okay? So, what we're actually going to do is just switch off there for a long while. All right. So, we ask the question, therefore, with First Corinthians 8 in front of us. In what way, then, could he say, we all have knowledge, and knowledge puffs up? Possibly in the sense that the word knowledge or gnosis, which meant practical knowledge. In other words, it meant that they all had inevitably developed positions of party spirit over these things. And this was then leading to the puffing up process. In contrast, the true position is that love or charity, agape love, edifies or builds up as a builder builds a house. And we've got to ask the question, whatever happened to the Jerusalem decrees? In verse 2, we then begin with an attack on the problem area. He says there, if any man think that he knows, oida, he's aware or perceives anything. He says he knows nothing. Nothing yet as he ought to know. No, absolutely. By way of contrast, again in verse 3, that word love comes out again. And then he says, if any man loves God, agape, the same is known or known absolutely of him. And having an opinion or a position on these things isn't a true position before God. The puffing up process is purely brother to brother. I mean, they've forgotten that God's above all. He's the one that makes the rules, and he's the one that will decide in the end. All right? So that's important to know. He's just stating that they don't know what they're going on about. They have forgotten the important principle of love. So verses 4 through to verse 6 then is the starting point for a doctrinal position to which both sides could agree. Remember we said there, one side, yes, they'll all agree. An idol is nothing in the world, cosmos. And on the other side, there is none other God but one. Now, just by way of an aside, put there Acts chapter 17, verses 23 to 26. When Paul came to Athens, he saw there a whole host of gods. And he saw there the altar to the unknown God. And they were so superstitious that they didn't want to leave anyone out. So if someone got left out, well, that's your altar. Okay? And so they had all these other gods. In verses 23 to 26, he deals with some of those issues. We'll look that up later on. But thirdly, he says there, although there are these so-called gods in heaven and earth, according to Greek culture, these reigned in the lofty slopes and heights of Mount Olympus, he says there, they're nothing. Absolutely nothing. Figment of the imagination. And when you actually see something there, they are just nothing but dressed up wood and stone and gilt over with gold and crimson. So what he does do is actually he says, okay, now let's get out your statement of faith. Pull it out. What do you find about this subject? And this is what he does do. And this becomes the doctrinal standard. And so we'll just click this one in. The doctrinal standard. In fact, Barclay actually shows in the text of what he's written, this is an indented little section, as if it's a little potted excerpt out of their statement of faith. All right? So the statement of faith is like this. But to us, he says there is one God. And that's what Paul was having a crack at, wasn't he, in Athens. One God, the Father, we are his children. Remember that? In Acts chapter 17, we are his children, for we are his offspring, as he reminded them that the very poets had said. And therefore, we shouldn't, he said, liken the Godhead to anything that we can make. It just doesn't really ring true. But here he says there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we by him. And I'd say to you that this is probably a very early statement of faith about the God who rules the universe and the position of Jesus Christ. It basically precedes the Apostles' Creed in that area of it. It's something that they all agreed to, and that was going to be his basis of working with them. Okay? So I thought that might be useful to actually have a look at that and see how it's documented. One God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him. One Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we by him. I'm not going to go into the subtle differences between those, but what I'd like to do is then move on so we can catch the theme out of this. So he says then, these things which are up on the screen, and as I said, it's echoes of Acts chapter 17. If you go then back to Romans 14, in verses 7 to 8, you can see a similar sort of theme, because what you have up on the screen is that we are intrinsically bound in with God because he is the great power over us all. Okay, verse 7, none of us lives to himself, no man dies to himself. In other words, no man is an island. For whether we live unto the Lord. Whether we die unto the Lord. Whether we live, therefore, or die, we are the Lord's. Similar sort of concept. So the believers in Corinth had to get into their minds that they couldn't do what they wanted to do in disregarding others in the meeting. Now, that was an important principle which he is attempting to get over. Okay? When we come then to verse 7 in 1 Corinthians in chapter 8, he says there, howbeit there's not in every man that knowledge, that gnosis, or that practical knowledge. Because he says that some with conscience of the idol cannot cancel out their past knowledge and experience. They cannot cancel out their past knowledge and experience. For, he says, they eat this meat as a thing offered to an idol. So brother A, strong brother, he says, yes, I agree, there's one true God and that an idol is nothing. Huh. Brother B, well, he says, I agree that there is one true God, but it's still an idol. It's still an idol. Brothers and sisters, some had come into the ecclesia who had been fully involved, and you might think I'm dramatising this, who had been fully involved at some stage with the services performed at the temple of the false god. And that meant a lot to him.
It was emblazoned on his brain. I'd like you to turn back to chapter 6. All right? Verses 8 to 9. Verse 9 in particular. He says, "Know you not that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Don't be deceived, neither..." Oh, fornicators? Does that ring a bell? "Nor idolaters, etc." First two on the list for Corinth are things which occurred in that special decree that was sent around of the matters of idolatry and of fornication. And he says, "Such were some of you." It's like a person has made in their life a great dramatic decision. They're going to give up the demon drink. But at times in their life, they can't walk past a hotel without getting the shakes and the jitters, and it gets them. They linger at the window, they smell the smells, and they hear the voices and the chatter and the good times. And it all comes back to them. And they meekly go in. And this was like these. They'd made a dramatic decision in their life. B's conscience was weak. But they had this familiarity. See, the experiences of life had weakened their mindset. And their conscience, being weak, is so easy to defile. I'll read out Rotherham's. But he says, "Some by their familiarity, even until now with the idol, as an idol sacrifice, eat it." Yes, they'd been up there umpteen times. And they'd had there the meat. And who knows what else they had. And it was a special problem to them. We notice there in verse 7 the word conscience. Diglot has it as consciousness. He has a consciousness about these things. Triggers it in his mind. Oh yes, I remember those days. It's association. Whether it's habit or association, brothers and sisters, it's entrenched through patterns in their minds. Someone invites him up there. He's now a Christadelphian. He has this great problem. He gets this invitation. "You are hereby summoned to this special dinner in honour of my mother-in-law." Up at this temple, right? And so he says, "Oh, I could upset him. He mightn't deal business with me anymore. Well, perhaps I'd better go. He might be offended." So he goes up, and all the smells of the burning flesh, the carousing going on, the eating and drinking and being merry that goes on up there, it's all on. He's going into the lion's den. It all depends how his conscience is to how he copes with it. All right? All those old remembrances come back into his mind, and it could come back and actually overwhelm him. Someone comes up and says, "How you doing there, big boy? Have a look in chapter 10 and you'll see what he is really talking about. But we won't look at it right now. Brethren and sisters, this is not just the fact that this brother has a not mental breakdown, a conscience breakdown, and he goes away with a headache. I mean, this is talking about real stuff. It could come back and overwhelm him. He had all good intentions of just drawing the line there, but the line got redrawn for him. And of course, brethren and sisters, when he was baptized, he realized that an idol was just a lump of stone and wood. He could look at the proof on the bottom of the instructor and say, yes, the proof is Isaiah 44, of the man who goes and cuts down a tree and he makes an idol out of one bit of it and he goes and burns the rest for cooking his meal. I mean, what stupidity is that? But it was what went with it that left an indelible mark in conscience and mind as the problem of recall happened for him. What then is the reason for these comments? Is it about the fact that if you went and touched that meat, that there was a problem with it? Well, he says there in verse 8, meat commends us not to God. I mean, it's not the problem with the meat, with meat itself, per se. For if we eat, are we the better? Neither if we eat not, are we the worse? Is this a problem, brethren and sisters, purely with this sort of soggy stuff here that's meat, and you can go and cook and it tastes nice? Verse 9. We find there, brother A, the focus comes onto him. He says, take heed, lest by any means this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to them that are weak. Brother A says, I have got no problems. Brother B says, what do I do? I've got a problem. Placed into that arena of the flesh, I could be a goner. Whatever the reason, whatever the background, it was detrimental to Brother B to have this problem there and him in the middle of it. It burdened his conscience unnecessarily with this dilemma. And by Brother A's remark to him and cajoling, you're not a weak man, are you? Oh, sorry, weak brother. I mean, goodness me, I thought the gospel would have done something for you by now. Doesn't bother me. Do you really think so? Yeah. Right. So it goes on. All it needed. You remember, you saw the walls up there? I mean, that's what good conscience is like. I mean, for modern generation like Samuel, it's the firewall. Okay? Spiritual firewall. In those days, they didn't have those sorts of things because they weren't invented. What they actually had were those great walls, right? Brick walls, stone walls, piled one on top of the other. You couldn't see over them. No problem then. Brother A, he was just picking one stone off after the other. That one, you won't need that one either. I mean, with me, you're safe. And he just pulls it down. And he's broken down this brother's conscience. And all it needed was the right triggers to be present. And that could be up there on Acrocorinthus, their Windy Point, their great restaurant of Aphrodite. Brother A, we could never have thought that a brother's stumbling was caused by someone else in the meeting, like himself. As I said here, and as Paul says, it wasn't the meat. It was the association, or as Paul says in chapter 10, the fellowship, okay? The Greek word koinonia, which also has the context of sharing. That's in verses 18 through to verse 21. So Paul's commentary now in verses 9 to 12 in this chapter is all about a very, very sad progression. I don't like using that word in this context, but it's a bit like, could be a little bit like Lot, gradually moving down to the city of Sodom. All right? This is the sort of progression. So verse 9, he says, this liberty of yours could become a stumbling block, proskoma, a cause to stumble to them that are weak. So your brother's going along with you in the road to the kingdom. Just pull out this boulder and shove it in front of him. Splat. And over he goes. You just made him to stumble by putting that stumbling block in front of him. And that was the problem. This liberty of yours has become a stumbling block. Because it wasn't a literal stone. Words are so cheap. He didn't think any more about it. So verse 10, he says, if any man see thee who hast this knowledge, well, he's a strong brother. If it's all right for him, it's all right for me. Sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him which is weak be emboldened? Oikodomio. Oikodomio. To build up as a house. You saw that in verse 1, all right? To eat those things which are offered to idols. In verse 11, he says, and then through your knowledge, or gnosis, practical knowledge, yeah, I'll show you the traps, right? Shall the weak brother perish? And this doesn't mean that he's just sort of, he gets over it and he's all right the next week. It's a polyumai, which means destroyed, for whom Christ died. And the context here isn't it not that Christ died for that man. He's a living man. But you went and killed him. You went and killed him. And that's what he's talking about. You went and killed him. And that is the great problem. And it comes out again in Romans chapter 14. So, the stumbling block did its job. It caused the stumble. The stones got picked out of the conscience wall. He could walk straight through there. And ultimately destroyed that brother. Yeah, here's the last one. The process of decline.
The liberty or power to do that is exercised. It becomes a stumbling block to the weak. The weak's conscience is edified or built up.
Oh, if he can do it, I can.
He therefore eats of the things which are offered to idols.
I'm saying in the context of that, in that there, yes, his conscience is turned upside down and it becomes a problem.
And then the weak brother stumbles, as the RV says.
The weak brother stumbles. And we pick that up, that he's actually going to be destroyed. And I don't think that any one of us here really wants to have that accusation made against us, that because of something which we did, we eventually compromised another's conscience so that he fell and turned away from Christ. Picked down the wall of defence and brought trouble. Have a look in Mark. Mark 9, verse 42. And here he says, whosoever shall offend, cause to stumble one of these little ones that believe in me, it's better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he were cast into the sea. You know, every time you hear in the news about some of these sexual predators, it actually grieves me. I mean, these people should know. They should know that this is a problem to their life. it was better for them on the grief and the continuing trouble that they caused to others. Far better that he went and found a millstone, went out the end of the jetty, and dropped in for a swim. What about Matthew 25? In verses 40 and 45. See, this is the context of knowing, in fact, that no man is an island, that he can think he can just live life how he likes without consequences to others. Read verse 40. The king shall say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto the one of the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. I mean, provided help and succour. Then shall he say unto them in verse 41, to those on his left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. Right, verse 45, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. So there is relationship. It's just like Paul says back there in Corinthians, we in him, we in him. This should come back to us all the time. There could be many examples, practical examples of this in ecclesial life. And every one of us, brethren and sisters, needs to see one another as one for whom Christ died. You know, people might come into the truth with baggage. And, I mean, our conduct here is such that that baggage should not be reignited. So let us make certain that we are very careful. And that's the spirit of Paul in this epistle to win people for Christ. Just have a look in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And I know someone's going to deal with this later on, but you can do with a recap. Verse 22. To the weak, he says, became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you. So, this small little chapter shows the spirit of Christ, agape love, care for one another, concern for one another, concern for the eternal well-being for one another, far outweighs the rights of any strong brother mentality which he might think he has. It's of course in the 9th and the 10th chapter that Paul's own example is therefore expressed. I'm giving you this so you can lead on to the next chapters. He puts up himself now as an example of caring for others. In chapter 9, against the Old Testament backdrop of the incidents, swinging back the other way, in chapter 10. Now this is showing the peril of things. This actually puts 1 Corinthians 10 into some helpful perspective. So they all came into the ecclesia, correct? Verses 1 to 4, they all had the same spiritual blessings. Then verses 5 to 11 is a story of mass failure. Mass failure of the ecclesia in the wilderness. Verse 8, let us not commit fornication. This is related to the theme of chapter 8. As some of them committed and fell in one day, 23,000. Right? So that is important, isn't it, in relationship to the problem of going up there on the Acrocorinthus and having anything to do with that system which is up there. What about verse 7? I mean, this is strange to say to brethren and sisters in an ecclesia, isn't it? But this is Corinth. Neither be ye idolaters, as were some of them. Oh, this was applicable. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Oh, was that ever applicable? I want you to cop this one, though. All right? So he goes through, doesn't he, in verse 12. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands, the strong brother, take lest he fall. For, he says, there has no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. You're no different to anyone else. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. Conclusion? Brother A and Brother B are busy going down that mountain fast as they can. Wherefore, he says, my brethren, flee idolatry. Do you think that's not related to chapter 8? I think it is. And that is the point, isn't it? Get out of there. Don't even go up there. If you find yourself up there, get out of there. Flee idolatry. Because it had all those other trappings with it. That's the practical way to do it. Imagine there's this one fellow is busy going down the hill there. Well, he's Brother B. At least he's more sensitive to it. And Brother A, Brother Strong, he realises he's made a mistake too. And he's busy fleeing. He's read this epistle. He said, all right, that's enough. I'm going. Don't want to do that anymore. The complete answer to chapter 8 is found in chapters 9 to 10, which will be dealt with in later classes. But one very powerful lesson, brethren and sisters, which I've just skimmed on, is this one. The Jerusalem Conference is now 8 years approximately from when we find ourselves in Paul writing this epistle. If it's 7, if it's 9, big deal. But there it is. It took that long for brethren in that meeting to set themselves up to be greater than what the wise advice of the apostles was to them. They were shifting the goalposts, and they're having, as it were, dangerous problems arising out of it. At Corinth, some said, it doesn't apply to me. And it was a big mistake for all in the meeting, an absolutely dangerous mistake. And that's why we look back to chapter 8 and verse 13. This is Paul's antidote. Right? Paul's antidote. Wherefore, he says, if meat make my brother to offend, I will eat flesh no more while the world stands, lest I make my brother to offend. He doesn't want to have done all that work in bringing people in the truth, being responsible for a bad example to others, by which they would have their consciences crushed, and these people for whom Christ died destroyed on the altar of one of these gods. It was just not right. I've got there, Paul passionately states his own pledge, which is in accordance with his past practice, chapter 9, verse 22. He is prepared to humble and deny himself according to the wishes of his Lord. Matthew 18 and verse 6, which is another reference similar to that one of Mark that we looked at. So we have very powerful lessons, brethren and sisters, which come out of this chapter. And no doubt, In particular, as we go through chapters 9 and chapter 10, we're going to have some terrific soul-searching lessons which will come out and will be there and help us to make certain that as we go onwards together as an ecclesia, we'll have that sound advice learned from experience by the Apostle Paul, which he taught to those at Corinth. May it be a help to each and every one of us, brethren and sisters, and so we can realise we're serving a greater cause instead of self, and the principle of love must be there to help us make those decisions in life, and that we know that when the Lord appears, we won't have any twinges of conscience about where we are and where we've been and how we've helped our brethren and sisters, inasmuch as you've done it to one of the least of these, my brethren.
Verse 11 talking about the end of the process, your brother perishing, it talks about in verse 11.
Yep. That perish there is that word which talks about destruction. That person's conscience has just been destroyed. I mean, he's gone and lost any sense of propriety which he's had in his life. He's all at sea. He's allowed things to creep in on his mind and eventually himself, and there lies the problem. Verse 13 is almost like a summary statement of where Paul stands.
Verse
strongly. I just got to pick it up, sorry. Yeah, that's a polyuma. And verse 12, smiting, is completely another different word altogether. I didn't pick that out as a meaning to place through, but it's different. Definitely a part way down the process stage. Striking a blow on the weak conscience. Striking a blow.
Well, we'd like to thank our brother David for his class tonight and for a few comments there. We'll now take the collection for the ACBM and ask Bob Murray to come forward for the announcements.